From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guest is Paul Farmer, medical doctor, anthropologist, and celebrated author. Dr. Farmer will be discussing his experiences providing medical care in Haiti, the poorest country in the hemisphere. And then, in today's Viewpoint segment, Werner Fornos will discuss the importance of overpopulation in generating poverty and ill health, and evaluate the Bush administration's policy on women's health services in the poor countries of the Global South. But first, some news from the world of public health. The Alan Guttmacher Institute recently released a survey outlining reproductive health needs of American men. The report found that most American men begin sexual intercourse in their teens, and half have married and become fathers by their late 20s. This means that men spend an average of about 10 years being sexually active and unmarried. They found that half of the births involving men in their late 20s and about a third in their 30s and 40s result from unintended conceptions. More than two-thirds of young men who became sexually active in the mid-1990s used a condom at first intercourse, compared with about one-quarter in the early 1980s. They found that most men have heard of HIV, AIDS, gonorrhea, and syphilis, but far fewer men know about genital warts or are aware that chlamydia can infect men. The report concludes that helping men obtain the sexual and reproductive health information and services they need to protect their own health and well-being also should result in lower levels of sexually transmitted diseases, fewer unwanted pregnancies and births, and better parenting. The use of psychotropic medications in children rose substantially during the 1990s, according to a study published in the journal Ambulatory Pediatrics. Between 1995 and 1999, the number of these prescriptions rose 20%, so that by 1999, 3% of American children were taking at least one psychoactive medication. Drugs used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, primarily amphetamines, were the most commonly prescribed. Drugs used for depression increased by over 70%. This study compiled data on 750,000 children covered by employer-sponsored insurance. The long-term impact of prescribing most of these medications to children is not known. Pharmaceutical manufacturers often complain that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's process for introduction of new drugs is too expensive and too slow. But a study published in JAMA this month found that despite the FDA's supposedly daunting approval process, 3% of approved drugs are later withdrawn from the market due to safety concerns, and over 10% of drugs allowed onto the market acquired a black box warning after their appearance on the market. A black box warning is attached to the labeling of a drug to alert prescribing physicians of the presence of a serious risk, usually a major side effect or drug interaction. The authors point out that studies done by drug companies prior to entry on the market often do not include a large enough sample size and do not extend out enough years to detect some important adverse effects. Despite the fact that recently released drugs are the most likely to have unknown adverse effects, these are the drugs that the pharmaceutical companies promote most heavily due to their concern about patent life, their desire to mold prescribing habits prior to the market entry of new competing drugs, and the hope that a rapid ramp-up in sales will increase the company's stock price. The authors recommend that the FDA raise its threshold for drug approval when safe and effective medicines already exist or when the drug is used to treat a minor condition. In a response from an FDA representative, it was noted that the FDA has established closer surveillance for three types of problems that frequently provoke warnings and withdrawals: drug interactions, liver toxicity, and cardiac electrical problems. And that in the future, this new surveillance is expected to identify problems with new drugs prior to their appearance on the market. Finally, a recently completed survey undertaken by the FDA found that 69% of patients requesting a drug they saw advertised on TV are given a prescription for that drug when they go to their doctor and ask for it. That study did not evaluate whether the prescription was appropriate for the patient's medical condition, but it is a testimony to the effectiveness of direct-to-consumer advertising of the drug industry. This is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we will be looking at health in Haiti. Haiti is the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, an island very close to the United States and very much living in our shadow. By most measures, Haiti has some of the worst health outcomes in the world. Our guest is Paul Farmer, who has worked in Haiti for nearly 20 years. After completing his PhD in anthropology, he undertook medical training at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Farmer remains in the faculty there in the program in infectious disease and social change. He co-founded Partners in Health, an organization that provides direct service in impoverished countries on three continents and also supports research and education. He currently spends the majority of his time serving as medical director of the Clinique Bon Sauveur in Haiti's Central Plateau, that country's poorest region. Dr. Farmer has written extensively about the role of social inequalities in the distribution and outcomes of readily treatable diseases. Today's interview reviews Infections and Inequalities. That book is available through the University of California Press. Paul Farmer, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Good to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Given your educational background, it's obvious you could have had your choice of career opportunities, most all of which would have gotten you better compensation. How did you decide to work in Haiti?
I had been following the plight of migrant farm workers when I was a student. I grew up in Florida. And the conditions that they were enduring were so bad, one had to wonder, well, what would make them leave their home country to work under these kind of conditions? And that's how I ended up in Haiti. And when I got there, I had a hard time justifying leaving, so that's how I ended up there. It's just the burden of disease was so enormous compared to anywhere else I'd been, and now, 18 years later, that's still true, so there I am.
Now, Haiti has a history of having repressive governments for many years, I guess the Duvaliers. When you're doing development work in a country with a repressive government, are you in a way, are you helping to buttress that government, which is not providing basic services for its people? How did you feel about that?
Well, I think that is an enormous trap, and so intervening in a place like that calls for a certain amount of restoring careful analysis. For example, going to Haiti in 1983 to simply say, well, I'm not going to work in Haiti because there's a repressive government would be not only unhelpful to people who are going through terrible things, it would also be dishonest because, of course, we have intervened in Haiti. You know, we were the primary supporters of the Duvalier dictatorships in terms of aid. The majority of foreign aid to the Duvaliers came from the United States and our allies. So to have someone come from, say, a university and say, well, this is really not conditions that would permit me to work in an honorable way, I'm not going to, that would be really sort of the attitude of a seminar room warrior. And so moving beyond that, the next set of questions is, okay, if you've decided to work with the Haitian poor, what would be the best way in which to do that? And I think then you would get down to a level of intervention that would include not only direct services, because these are people living with huge problems that require direct services, again, medicine, food, water. But you'd also want to work on the level of educating your fellow Americans who may or may not know, and Europeans as well for that matter, who may or may not know what's going on, who may or may not be busy trying to erase history. And so our group has tried to work to deliver services at the same time where they're trying to document the nature of what you call repressive regimes. Right now, for example, there's enormous confusion about Haiti. Haiti does not have a repressive regime now, has a very forward-thinking, progressive regime, which is why the international community is so opposed to it. And so educating the particularly the American populace about what the Haitian government is all about now and how it is in fact representative of the aspirations of the majority is another heavy task for people interested in health and you know, public health and medicine. In other words, it's not really what you sign up for, but it's part of the work if you're going to have a social justice approach.
You, in your book, you describe the logic that leaders in the rich country use in rationalizing the miserly amount of humanitarian aid that we give to Haiti and other extremely poor countries. I wonder if you could describe some of these methodologies.
Well, you know, some of them, I think, many of them, I would say, are potentially very effective tools. For example, cost-effectiveness analyses. If you had a limited amount of money, as all NGOs do, by and large, you'd want to use them in the wisest way possible.
NGOs, you mean the
non-governmental organizations, like, say, for example, Partners in Health, our NGO. We want to use the money that we have available wisely. However, it's a completely different kind of analysis that we see going on now with the World Bank and other international financial institutions imposing a very arbitrary and, again, as you said, miserly level as the amount that is available for these projects, these public health projects. That might be the amount available to an NGO like Partners in Health. It's not the amount available to the powerful. They're basically hiding away the majority of the pie and saying that it's not available and we have to make do with these paltry amounts. And, you know, so again, we're working on several different levels at once. We're working on the level of responding to the emergencies and at the same time exposing the ways in which these logics, I mentioned cost effectiveness, but the ways in which these logics don't serve the interest of the poor. They don't serve the interest of those who've already lost out in the partition of the pie. So if the pie is already sliced up and the rich world has 99% of it, and then we're then start squabbling over how best to apportion that 1% to all of the good work that we should be doing around health, public health, education, social welfare, etc., then, you know, we're really buying into a logic that doesn't serve the interest of redistribution so that people could be healthy. And at the same time, we are engaged in spending that 1% or whatever it may be. I think we also need to be engaged in exposing the ongoing inequalities and how they get structured over time and then maintained. These inequalities are shored up by very strong forces, and I don't think you have to be a sociologist to understand what they are and where they come from. I think that every doctor, nurse, public health person has an obligation to be engaged in this part of the work too, many are. I think there's still a lot of physicians, for example, I'm sure you know this from your work, who don't feel engaged in the struggle for social equity, but they should, because inequalities of one sort or another are what structure the risk for many of their patients, whether it be for anything from coronary artery disease to addiction, and certainly to HIV and the infectious diseases that I deal with. The social inequalities are probably the leading cofactors, for example, for the transmission of HIV. What kind of social inequalities? Gender inequality and poverty would be the biggest ones in Haiti or sub-Saharan Africa. And yet they're really difficult problems to get your arms around. They're very much easier to focus on one little part of the problem, but the problem unfortunately fits into this larger context of social inequality. So back to the logics that underpin so many of these interventions, for example, naming an intervention cost-effective, whereas another one is not cost-effective. Well, right now, I'm in New York, came here from Haiti last night to participate in the United Nations General Assembly on AIDS, and I can pretty easily identify which interventions are designated as cost-effective ones and which are not, as far as AIDS goes. And I know, again, that these are completely arbitrary kinds of designations. The World Bank says that prevention is is cost-effective HIV prevention, but treatment isn't, then the first thing you'd want to ask is, well, how do you come at those figures, and who sets the bar, and who decides how much drugs should cost in the context of an international public health emergency, et cetera. And that discussion is really just getting warmed up now, 20 years into the epidemic.
Now the other rationale, or I guess rationale may be the best word, for people in the wealthier countries to not provide more aid is that culturally those people are somehow different. They wouldn't understand it or use it well or appreciate it. They're almost in a different form of human than we are, or something like that. Can you describe that?
Well, the funny thing about that logic is that they wouldn't know how to use it, is that the very people who don't use aid correctly in these settings are the ones most like us. So we end up giving the majority of aid money to bureaucracies and the people who most look like us. And they're the ones, of course, who are more likely to misuse it. I mean, the example would be the many corrupt regimes that we funneled aid through. You know, Haiti is, of course, an extreme example, but after 1986, when the Duvaliers left with a lot of ill-gotten gains, as everyone knows, the less well-known part of the story is that our chief receptacle for aid after 1986 was the Haitian army. And you know, a more corrupt institution you would have a hard time finding. And for many people in Haiti, were saying to whoever would listen, including their elected officials, don't give money to the Haitian army. Let's put it this way, their public health track record is not good. Their education track record is not good. Their road building track record is not good. So there was really no reason to funnel aid, development aid, or charity through a very corrupt and violent institution like the army, except that it served U.S. foreign policy interests, or was perceived to. But the amount of money we're talking about is hundreds of millions of dollars. One source estimates $220 million in 18 months after the Duvaliers left was funneled through the military junta. So these are major expenditures by any accounting, and from the point of view of a Haitian peasant, say, who's being subjected to this rough, crude cost-effectiveness analysis, this is a huge, huge expenditure of money that could have been used much more wisely in another way. So the idea that they're a different species, getting back to this, is it's really coming out very clearly now when we hear people talk about why we can't treat HIV disease in some of these places. I mean, I'm sure been following the debate around on the 29th of April, for example, in the New York Times, you can hear a high-ranking U.S. Treasury Department official say that we can't treat HIV in Africa because they have, and I quote, a different concept of time. And this was before the head of USAID started mimicking these comments by saying that people didn't know how to tell time. So these are the kind of commentaries that you hear all the time in the aid world, but they usually don't get said on the front page of the papers. So with the debates that are going on now, that is the many, many excuses for not intervening effectively. These are pretty much the staple of commentary off the record in the international public health and development worlds.
You mean the upper echelons?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have that much direct contact. I mean, for example, in Haiti, I don't know that I've ever been in many of these bureaucracies in the 18 years I've been working there. It is possible to be in a completely parallel universe or an almost parallel universe, but at the same time, of course, I go to these meetings and conferences and these international meetings like the one I'm attending now, and I hear these things from the upper echelon.
Now, let's focus a little more narrowly on Haiti just for a little bit. Even before HIV came along, Haiti does conjure up images to Americans, poverty, voodoo, whatever. Can you describe both sides of the looking glass, Americans' views of Haiti and how they're distorted, and then the reverse?
Well, let me start by talking about Haitian views of Americans. Let me just throw some of them out there. There's the idea that the United States is very wealthy, Well, that happens to be correct. There's the idea that the United States has been very involved in propping up the dictatorships. Again, that happens to be correct. There's the recollection that the United States militarily occupied Haiti for decades in the 20th century. That also is correct. There's the idea that the United States and Haiti have this long-standing and intimate relationship over the centuries, and again, that's correct. Haiti and the United States are the two oldest republics in the hemisphere. They have the longest relations of any two countries in the hemisphere. The United States is the oldest country, and Haiti is the second oldest country. So the Haitians have a lot of, no doubt they have a lot of wacky ideas about the United States as well, but the main thrust of the popular perception of the United States in Haitian minds is really fairly well buttressed by fact. Whereas I don't think the converse is true as far as American ideas about Haiti go. I think there's much more distortion, much more inaccuracy in the American folk model of Haitians than there is in the Haitian folk model of Americans. And, you know, there have been whole books written about this. How is this constructed over time? The notion of course, you know, if Americans think that Haiti is very, very poor, that's true. It is very poor. And if they think that the Haitian population is sick, that's true too. But I think of the Haitian people as having been impoverished over time. The word impoverished is different from poor, which is a static word. It takes, you know, decades to wreak this kind of havoc, and it's important to know how it happened. So the ideas about Haitians poor, you know, the superstition, they're really quite distorted. And not only are they distorted in the sense of being inaccurate now and having always been inaccurate, they also erase history, how this all happened over time. So the Haitians, in my view, are more likely to restore history and to talk about history as if it were alive and vibrant and determining what's happening now. I actually believe that they're correct.
Regarding the American attitudes toward Haiti, one of the most remarkable things I've seen during my whole 20 years as a doctor was when the CDC labeled being Haitian as a risk factor itself for HIV, as if a microscopic virus could determine somebody's country of origin. Do you know the origins of that, how the CDC came to that?
Maybe this strikes you as naive, but my assumption is that this is not part of some public health conspiracy to tarnish the Haitians and their international reputation. So I will go back to the early 80s and look at what really happened and what documentation we can have. It's pretty abundant, as you might imagine. Big bureaucracies leave a pretty impressive paper trail. And where did HIV come from in Haiti? Well, it actually came from American tourists, probably, not vice versa. Remember the idea back in the early 80s was that HIV came to the United States from Haiti. Well, probably the converse was true. And how did that happen? Well, in the context of transnational sex, that's for sure. And clearly money changed hands. You know, it's pretty crude to talk about international sex work, but clearly we're talking about sexual contact across a very steep gradient of social inequality. That's how HIV was introduced to Haiti, from American tourists.
In other words, wealthy HIV-infected American tourists traveled to Haiti seeking inexpensive prostitutes, and that's how HIV was introduced to Haiti?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. This is about close ties between a very rich country and a very poor country, and that's how HIV was introduced. Now, once introduced into the population, it doesn't need these transnational inequalities anymore. It just needs people to be sexually active, which, of course, people are sexually active. So it spread along different routes after it was introduced. But it does matter that that's where it came from, I think. It certainly matters in terms of getting the story straight. So none of this was clear to those who were studying it. They were just seeing a fair number of HIV cases in a very restricted number of so-called communities. People who used injection drugs, men who had sex with men, people who were the recipients of blood products, and then Haitians. And so you had four groups, the so-called 4-H Club, one of which was a nation state. And as you pointed out, it makes no sense to think that a virus could discriminate based on nationality. Made no sense whatsoever, not epidemiologically, not virologically, not socially, not culturally. It made no sense. However, there were these pre-existing templates, what I call the folk model about Haitians. So it had to all fit into this folk model, and that's where people came up with the idea of voodoo and strange cult practices, etc. All of them incorrect ideas, but they were, you know, had a huge impact. And even to this day, I'm not so sure people understand what really happened. They don't understand the real story. The incorrect story is so much more appealing and so much more worthy of press attention.
Now, once the CDC had actually labeled being Haitian as a risk factor, can you just briefly describe the effect that had on Haiti?
Well, it had an enormous effect on Haiti and on Haitians. So on the country, which was then dependent to a significant extent on tourism, for example, for foreign exchange, the tourist industry really collapsed very rapidly. Within a year after this labeling as a, you know, a special risk group for HIV, the tourism declined by probably 90%. And some people would later ask, well, this may have been one of the reasons that Haiti became so destabilized in the 80s, was it became poorer as a result of this labeling. That was on the Haitian economy and the Haitians living in Haiti. But in the Haitians living in the United States, Canada, and Europe, it had an equally profound impact because, you know, there were all these stories of people refusing to get into cabs, if they were driven by Haitians, of parents withdrawing their children from schools where there were Haitian kids. It was really a very profound impact back in the 80s on the Haitians in Haiti and in the diaspora as well.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. We've been discussing health in Haiti with Paul Farmer, who has worked there for nearly 20 years. After the break, we'll focus on the lives of women in Haiti and also the role of development assistance from the U.S. and other wealthy countries. And later in our Viewpoint segment, Werner Fornos will discuss the importance of overpopulation in generating poverty and ill health, and evaluate the Bush administration's policy on women's health services in impoverished countries. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Farmer, and we're discussing his experiences working for about 20 years in Haiti. To help listeners better understand the impact of the HIV epidemic on women, I'd like to ask you to read the passage from your book, Infections and Inequalities, that describes the case history of Anita Joseph.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Anita Joseph was born in approximately 1966 to a family that had lost its land to the Pelig Dam. One of six children, she briefly attended school until her mother, weakened by the malnutrition then rampant in the Kai area, died of tuberculosis. Anita was then 13. Her father became depressed and abusive, and she resolved to run away. This is her voice. I'd had it with his yelling. Then I saw how poor I was and how hungry, and saw that it would never get any better. I had to go to the city. Back then, I was so skinny. I was saving my life, I thought, by getting out of here. Anita left for Port-au-Prince with less than $3 and no clear plan of action. She worked briefly as a restavec or live-in maid for $10 a month, but lost this position when her employer was herself fired from a factory job. Cast into the street, Anita eventually found a relative who took her in. The kinswoman, who lived in a notorious slum north of the capital, introduced her to Vincent, a young man who had worked unloading luggage at the airport. Anita was not yet 15 when she entered her first and only sexual union. "What could I do, really?" she sighed as she recounted the story much later. "He had a good job. My aunt thought that I should go with him." Vincent, who had at least one other sexual partner at the time, became ill less than 2 years after they began sharing a room. The young man, whom Anita cared for throughout his illness, died after repeated infections, including tuberculosis. Not long after his death, Anita herself fell ill with tuberculosis. Upon returning to Dokai, the village, in 1987, she quickly responded to anti-tuberculous therapy. When she relapsed some months later, we performed an HIV test, which revealed the true cause of her immunosuppression. Following a slow decline, Anita died in February 1988. I would add that someone like Anita now would be on therapy in our clinic. We're probably the only people using these new medications, but
the only ones using those medications in the entire country.
In rural Haiti, I fear perhaps in the whole country we're the only ones using them yet. Although there are other groups who very much want to, aren't waiting for the prices to go down.
When you recount that story, how does that factor into what women in poor countries, what causes them to become HIV infected, and what happens once they are HIV infected?
Well, you know, it's a very paradigmatic story. Here you have young women driven to Port-au-Prince because they don't have any food, any jobs, who are put into very precarious situations where they're vulnerable to being exploited. And that's not the language that gets used necessarily, the language of exploitation, but very often that is exactly the language that these young women are using. They're saying, we were exploited, and we had partners who we thought could help us or take care of our kids, and who were their partners? Well, they weren't peasant farmers. They were soldiers, truck drivers, people with jobs who had access. These are men, of course, who had access to women, basically. And I have a hard time describing a story like Anita's, reflecting on a story like Anita's, without thinking about poverty and gender inequality. I think those are really the key to the epidemic in rural Haiti, poverty and gender inequality, just as a decade early, the key had been transnational inequalities. That's how HIV got into Haiti. And then it spread along very different lines, that is, not from Americans to Haitians, but from men to women. But they're very different lines, but they still involve really, again, steep grades of social inequality. So HIV worked itself into rural Haiti along these other lines. The majority of women with HIV who show up in our clinic have not lived in rural Haiti only. They've been living in Port-au-Prince. They've been working as a maid. They have a partner who's a truck driver or a soldier. Again, all of these things are difficult to describe without recourse to descriptions of social inequality.
And their sexual behavior, just to reiterate, their sexual behavior is basically derived from their economic poverty, it sounds like.
Right, and you know, I'm so accustomed to hearing these stories now. I had a reminder that this can deform the way you see these things, because I'm so used to having patients come in, usually women, come in and tell me these stories about how their ostensibly romantic choices were not affective, but they were economic. And the women's group I work with in Haiti ended up making a video about this, which is called Cherche la vie, détruit la vie, which means in Creole, looking for life, destroying life. And the idea underpinning the video, which is in soap opera format, is that this young woman ends up doing the same thing that Anita did, which is go to Port-au-Prince to work as a maid because she had no options. And to get out of working as a maid, she ended up striking up relationships first with a truck driver and then with a soldier. And why a truck driver and why a soldier? It's always the same story, as far as I can tell, also in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's not because truck drivers and soldiers are somehow particularly alluring. It's because in a setting of enormous poverty, truck drivers and soldiers were the ones in rural Haiti, in any case, who had access to any money at all. And the peasant farmers, who were the people most likely to become, they were the guys most like the women in question in terms of their background and what they did, which was work the land, they also had no money. They also couldn't feed their kids. So, again, these are stories of social inequality. The good thing about the Haitians is they tend to get to the point pretty quickly. They tend to point out that these are stories of social inequality before the visiting doctor or anthropologist gets a chance to ask those questions. They'll just say it flat out.
One of the interesting things in your book is that you look at those two professions, medicine and anthropology, and you find that the dominant ways of looking at their own patients or their own craft, in the case of anthropology, that they're both pretty wanting. Can you describe that in a little more detail?
When I talk about the blind spots of medicine, I think about American medicine. And American medicine is not built on the idea that healthcare is a right. It's built on the idea that healthcare is a commodity that is paid for. And it just so happens that we're living in an incredibly affluent country, and so it can be made to look tolerable because it's just so much money in the United States that you can hide away the destitute sick and not see them. You don't see them crowding into the emergency rooms and not having access to primary care and dying of asthma or untreated hypertension or, for that matter, HIV. You can hide that away to some extent. Of course, it's still there and it's just being hidden. But I think that if one were looking for the blind spots of American medicine, it would be the treatment of the poor. It's the best medicine in the world, no doubt, in terms of the heights to which we can rise in providing, you know, excellent care and to some people. At the same time, that would be the weak point of American medicine, is that we don't do a good job taking care of the American poor. Going to anthropology, it's been my argument, the blind spot was not the what is the importance of culture. That is the sort of the currency of anthropology is culture. That's the group that does understand culture. The blind spot is that people in anthropology, American anthropology, don't understand poverty, social inequality, and end up confusing what you might want to call structural violence, that is, social inequalities. They end up seeing structural inequalities, violence, structural violence, and thinking that it's a cultural difference, not difference due to, again, gender inequality, poverty, social inequalities of one sort or another. So that has been, I think that there's the blind spots in both of these, my two disciplines, are really related to, again, poverty, social inequalities.
When picking up on this notion of culture, many of the foreigners from wealthier countries who travel to the third world talk about the main problem as being the low educational levels of the populations, whether they're talking about HIV spread or why multi-drug resistant tuberculosis is spreading in poor countries. Could you just talk about that for a bit?
Well, you know, I think the whole breakthrough in international TB control is really embarrassingly simple, because it's not about the new drugs. The drugs that are so powerful and effective have been around for decades. The breakthrough is something that's called directly observed therapy, and that is giving the patient the pills. Now, how silly is that? In other words, how hard should it have been to figure that out? Now, what does that do in terms of education? It removes what the patient may think about, say, the etiology of tuberculosis from the equation. And, you know, this is not very popular in many circles to say, well, we should remove it. Should it matter what you think is the cause of tuberculosis, you, the patient, or should the outcome of treatment matter? And I think, of course, everybody's ideas are important. But at the same time, the outcome of treatment is what should interest doctors and nurses and community health workers. And in fact, it is what interests doctors, nurses and community health workers. So if you give someone their therapy under direct observation, that is, a community health worker gives the patient the pill, 6 months later, the patient's cured, no matter if he or she thought that sorcery is the cause of tuberculosis or a mycobacterium. It doesn't. The outcome's the same, cure. And also, from a public health point of view, end of transmission. Now, HIV, interestingly, has a very similar set of issues at stake. So far, all of our interventions in prevention are based on what you could call the cognitive model. That is, the reason that HIV is still being transmitted at a staggering rate is that people are ignorant of the details of transmission. The problem with that hypothesis is we can't ever show that it's true. If you interview people in rural Haiti, and they tell you that HIV can be transmitted in two ways. One, as a sexually transmitted pathogen, and two, through sorcery. And I've heard this many times. But that error would not lead to increased rates of HIV transmission because it's an exaggeration of transmissibility. Now, what will that have to do with HIV transmission? I would say nothing. So there's still a lot of proof lacking that for either of these two diseases that patient education is the way to move forward sound prevention program. I would say that if we want to focus on education, we should educate the powerful or stop the powerful from creating social inequalities that are this staggering, so staggering that it doesn't matter if poor women know about HIV transmission. They still end up putting themselves in risky situations because of their extreme poverty. Now, that's not a very comfortable and not a very popular view inside HIV circles. But I think that there's a lot more support for that reading of why HIV continues to be transmitted than there is because it's, patient ignorance. I think there's plenty of places where people know everything they would need to know to protect themselves from HIV if indeed what's inside their head is what's determining risk. But I don't think that what's inside their head is what's determining their risk. It's what's inside their lives that is no food for the kids, no job, gender inequality, compounding all this. That's what's determining their risk. And, of course, our interventions are not targeted towards relieving those problems. They're targeted towards relieving ignorance.
Could you go into a little more detail at this point about the U.S. and other wealthy countries and whether, if you look at some of what the U.S. does, it may be helpful, medical and development aid. You pointed out that that aid is often targeted in a way that's not helpful, at least in the past. And then there's activities of the World Bank, which is a creature of the wealthy countries. Can you just describe, are we helping them? Is our aid grossly insufficient? How do you see it?
Well, I'm not of the school that thinks that you can suddenly cut off foreign aid and that the poor countries will be better off. Again, that erases history and political economy. Now it's too late. Now you take a place like Haiti. Haiti is being strangled by no foreign aid right now. I mean, the process of strangling Haiti is now in the chapter where cutting off aid makes things even worse. And, there's this strain of romanticism inside progressive circles where people will say, well, Haiti would be better off if there really were no aid whatsoever. That may have been true at one point when there were still trees and topsoil and water. And, then you could make an argument looking back and saying, well, if only in the early 19th century Haiti had been able to isolate itself from the, inegalitarian development that was going on regionally and globally. Maybe that's true. I don't know. But I do know that now, in this long process of strangling Haiti, cutting off all aid and credit and even loans is not going to help the Haitian people. In fact, now is a time. We were so ready to give aid to the Duvaliers. There was no problem. Hundreds of millions of dollars through all the international financial institutions. There was no problem then. Suddenly there's really a democratic government that was elected by popular acclaim, and now we're having all these qualms about giving aid. That's absurd to me, and I'm just surprised that it's not more commented on in the American press. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised, but it is pretty amazing that, again, no problem for the Duvaliers, but wait a second, this guy Aristide, what are his democratic bona fides? So Do I think that aid is hypocritical? Absolutely, as currently run. Do I think that it is that it is causing problems as currently administered? Absolutely. Do I think that we should cut off aid to poor countries? Not at all. I think that there are ways of redistributing global wealth through these major international financial institutions that would be good, and that we should do, and we should do it with a sense of awareness about what happened in the past and about how these inequalities were structured over time and how they could best be remediated. And of course, you'd have to have good partners in country X, Y, or Z. But I don't think it's impossible to identify people who are pushing for whatever you want to call it. I would be a little reluctant to say democracy, because I've seen how perverted that word can be, so that, for example, we were easily able to fund all of these really terrible right-wing governments in Latin America by claiming they were democratic when in fact they weren't. So I don't even like using that word anymore. But if you think about social and economic rights, that is the right to live, to have clean water, to have health care, to have education for your children, can we identify in each of these settings groups, movements, even governments that are promoting the basic fundamental rights of their people? I think the answer is yes. In every setting, we have the tools, we have communication tools, we have the ability to do the analysis, so we could easily find partners who are promoting the well-being of the majority, and in most of these cases, these are the poor majority, and we could use these resources, which are huge, in ways that would make a difference. So I believe that it is possible to have reasonable, sensible, and just aid programs, and that we should look for those, and we should push those. We shouldn't just give up. It's too late now. Again, the process of strangling these countries is far enough along that if you suddenly say, well, we're not going to have aid at all, then it's the coup de grace for some of these countries.
Paul, can you direct interested listeners to how to contact your organization and potentially other allied organizations should they want to learn more or make a contribution?
Absolutely. Our group is called Partners in Health, and it's on the web under PIH. And we have links to other groups that are engaged in this kind of work.
Dr. Paul Farmer, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It was a real pleasure.
Thanks again, Paul. And once again, Paul Farmer's book, Infections and Inequalities, is available through the University of California Press. Coming up next, today's Viewpoint segment. Today's opinion segment comes from Werner Fornos, who will discuss the impact of world population growth on global security and public health. Werner Fornos has been in the forefront of the struggle to balance the world's population with the world's resources for more than 20 years. He's a graduate of the University of Maryland with a degree in government and politics, and later served on the faculty at George Washington University, where he headed the university's global population program. Mr. Fornos' dedication to the issue of population stabilization has made him an internationally recognized leader in the field. He's been awarded the UN Population Award 4 times, most recently in 1997. He joined the Population Institute in 1978 and became its president 4 years later. He has served as a management consultant on family planning programs for over a dozen countries throughout Africa and Asia. Werner Fornos, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you, Marvin. The terrorist attacks that occurred 7 months ago highlighted front and center that the world we live in is smaller than many of us may wish. Places that may have seemed remote and distant 15 years ago, such as Tanzania and Afghanistan, no longer seem quite so far away. And our government needs to carefully evaluate what actions truly make our country more secure in this ever-shrinking world. So far, the Bush administration has primarily chosen a military response. And even after a proposed 50% increase in foreign humanitarian aid as a proportion of gross national product, the United States will still be the least generous of the world's wealthy countries in providing basic humanitarian aid to the poor countries of the world. In the discussions about our national security, one key element impacting our security has been ignored: the ability of the world to handle overpopulation. Let's consider some startling facts. In 1900, global population was 1.6 billion. During the 20th century, the world's population grew four times larger, reaching 6 billion by the year 2000. And it's not stopping there. We currently add 80 million people to the world population each year, virtually all of them in the world's poorest countries. Such rapid growth puts us on a collision course with disaster. There are simply not enough natural resources in the world to meet fundamental human needs at this pace of world population growth. Currently, millions of people do not have access to life's necessities like food, shelter, health care, education, or employment. Half of the world's population, 3 billion people, subsist on $2 a day or less. These harsh socioeconomic and environmental realities contribute to civil strife and political unrest, destabilizing geopolitical balances and threatening our own national security and global security as well. A key cause of global unrest is the frustration and disillusionment suffered by those caught in the perpetual cycle of poverty, hunger, and social disintegration, a cycle worsened and ensured by overpopulation. By 2050, one-fourth of the world's population will live in countries facing chronic shortages of a safe fresh water supply. By 2050, one-fourth of the world's population will live in countries facing chronic shortages of a safe fresh water supply. Dietary consumption of fish is a critical source of protein to millions across the globe. 70% of the world's fisheries are depleted or in a state of collapse. Cropland available for producing grain has fallen by a half since 1950. In 57 developing countries, over half of all farms are currently less than 2.5 acres, not enough to feed the average rural family of 4 to 6 children. In the past 25 years, 33% of the forests and wilderness areas of the world have been wiped out. At current deforestation rates, the last significant tropical forest could be harvested within 50 years, leading to catastrophic environmental disasters. Four principal factors that aggravate overpopulation: lack of education, discrimination against women, high infant mortality, and poor access to family planning services. Women with access to education generally have fewer children. Today, 50% of the world's women cannot read. Worldwide, there are 300 million school-aged children not enrolled in school. About 60% are girls. Discrimination against women fuels overpopulation. In most societies, men have the preponderance of power. When women can participate in the decisions that affect their lives, they tend to have smaller, healthier, and better educated families. Furthermore, women must have equal employment opportunities. Income earned by women has been linked to improvement in child health, smaller family size, and greater school enrollment for girls. It may seem to be a paradox, but societies with a higher probability of infant survival have less population growth. Couples who know the children they bring into the world will survive generally opt for fewer pregnancies. One key element that improves infant survival is the spacing of pregnancies at least 2 years apart. This action alone would eliminate 1 in 4 infant deaths worldwide. Universal access to effective contraception is a critically important measure to control world population. At least 120 million couples in the developing world want to limit childbearing but do not have access to family planning services. The number of reproductive age couples is expected to increase by at least 20 million each year, making the need to deliver family planning services all the more urgent. Without the ability to plan and space their children, many women find it impossible to finish their education or plan a future. Empowering women with the choice to determine family size is a powerful defense against overpopulation and its consequences. Some, regrettably, influential political leaders in the U.S. Congress have alleged that international family planning programs provide abortions and should therefore not receive their support. Millions of couples across the globe wish to use contraception but do not have access to affordable means or to the knowledge to do so. Experts estimate that among the millions of unintended pregnancies these couples produce, approximately 800,000 are aborted each year. In fact, the Bush administration has failed to include any support for the UN's family planning program in next year's budget and has refused to release any of this year's funds for family planning that was already approved by both houses of the Congress. The short-sighted policy the administration has taken toward international family planning actually leads to nearly a million more abortions than would occur if we provided contraception to couples seeking that service. To give you one example, in Bogota, Colombia, a 33% increase in the use of all forms of contraception between 1976 and 1990 was accompanied by a 40% drop in the abortion rate. The failure to invest in proven family planning programs is counterproductive in many ways. I ask you to take three key actions. Write or email your congressional representatives and the president and insist that the United States government not sacrifice the lasting security that can be achieved through humanitarian assistance, including family planning. Our government should support equal rights for women across the globe, not merely where it is politically expedient. We should support women's access to employment and to educational opportunities. And finally, our support for family planning programs in the poorest countries of the global South should substantially increase until all of the 120 million couples who desire access to family planning methods but lack the means finally have high-quality contraceptive services available to them. Second, donate to organizations that provide advocacy and education on this issue. These include my own organization, the Population Institute. Another important option is to support direct service providers such as the International Planned Parenthood Federation. And finally, last but not least, learn more about the impact of overpopulation on the environment and on the public health. The website of my organization, populationinstitute.org, all one word, is a great place to start. Thank you for your interest in this issue.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Fornos.
Thank you, Marvin.
Well, that's it for today's show. In upcoming airings of Public Health Radio, we'll be looking at breast cancer, who should be screened, and what factors have led to the seemingly endless increase in the number of American women impacted by the disease. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time for Public Health Radio.